Welcoming back to the program our friend Colin Fleming, writer and critic and a man about the streets of Boston, climbing up an edifice near you. Hello, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. I missed you last week. Sorry, I was down and out. My week was not the same.
Yeah, well, get yourself a neti pod, and we'll try to avoid it going forward, right?
I think that's crucial as we move ahead here. Well, we want to talk this time about a couple of pieces that you've got out on the genius, the talent, the originality of one John Lennon. And as you write, Strawberry Fields was in many ways a real turning point in his songwriting.
Strawberry Fields, yes. It was a composite where Lennon had basically a slow version of the song, and then he had this kind of almost driven proto heavy metal version of the song with Ringo Starr just playing his ass off, really. And he wanted to combine the two, and this would not have worked because they're in a different pitch, they're a different key. And he basically said to George Martin, "I, sir, text you with fixing this problem, and I'm off. Take care of it. Let me know when you're done." And Martin was able to basically splice the two together. He slowed down the one, and then went into the same pitch, and it was close enough, and boom, there you go. So this kind of idea of taking the orange and the apple and making a superfruit lingered on into the White Album sessions, where Lennon couldn't come to a satisfactory conclusion for what he wanted to do with Revolution. You know, of course, the very metal-esque Revolution version that you hear on the radio with that just screaming guitar part right at the beginning of it. And then you know the loping version from the White Album, where it's almost like this kind of folksy type of everyone clap along deal. And then you have Revolution number 9, which is much maligned, but I think unfairly so. But basically what happened was there was the loping revolution, and there was Revolution number 9, and Lennon made an attempt, though not a lot of people have heard this, to have them go together.
And that was what you call what is known as take 20 of the song.
Right. It was take 20, where you have that kind of aleatoric Philip Glass type of Stephen Reich music, right? The whole number 9 and I Become Naked and all of that from the whole collaboration there with Yoko Ono. And the two actually work fairly well together. They almost, in a way, when pieced together, they encapsulate sort of the feel of the White Album itself. The White Album is the great stylistic melange of popular music. Now, we have examples of this in classical music. Handel was a great sort of melanger. If you listen to something like Messiah, there's so many different strands, so many different forms of music in there, and it was kind of like his White Album from 1743, but here we are, right, all these couple of 2.5 centuries later. And you had this going on where it's almost like a melange within a melange, and I think the Beatles pulled back on it because it was a bit too much. And I think Revolution number 9 works so well as a standalone track, as laudable as this idea was, because it's basically like the only form of music when you get to the end of this double record set, in terms of popular music, that the Beatles haven't explored yet. There's Broadway, there's schmaltz, there's heavy metal, there's blues rock, there's folk, there's Beach Boys pop, there's country and western, there's rockabilly, there's so many things going on. And heavy metal, and so you come to the end, and it's like, okay, well, let's do avant-garde classical music. And what I like about it is when you reach the end of the song, the performance piece, whatever you want to call it, the collage, it's almost like you've come out the backside of a forest. And with the strings of Goodnight, they're so lush and everything, and we're going into this kind of almost Bing Crosby-type number. It's almost as if like it's the enunciation of song itself, of the song form. So it ends this album on this sort of note of benediction. And I like the sound of him wrestling with that idea within a single song with this take number 20, where it's like, okay, we're doing rock and roll, we're doing revolution. It's like, yeah, now we're doing craziness. Oh, let's do a little more revolution again. And you can see him working through these ideas.
And I've heard people say before, oh, well, the White Album is simply the sound of the Beatles breaking up. I don't interpret it that way. I often think of it as an album of guys sharing with their longtime friends and bandmates their own personal interests. And here's where I've gone in my songwriting talent. Would you like to lend a little backup vocal or a little guitar part, George? What do you think?
I think it's much more cohesive than that. I think it's really probably ultimately the quintessential Beatles concept album. It is an exploration of the history of Western recorded sound. That is the concept. And it is more successful in the full extent of that concept than Sgt. Pepper is. The concept with Pepper is abandoned right after two songs, and then you get the reprise at the end, and then you have A Day in the Life, which is kind of like this apocalyptic encore by a post-Beatles, post-Pepper band. And who is that unit performing that even? It's like Ghosts from on High or something. But I think with the White Album, yeah, there is a component every now and again of, okay, well, you come in and you harmonize on this. But that's how they worked from the get-go. That is right there. Mm. Once you get past Please Please Me, which is basically a live set in the studio, and you get to With the Beatles, you have what I think of as the Beatles sheen. You have that overlay of production and style on top of the substance. With the Beatles has a Beatlesque sheen, and you get that all the way up until you get to the White Album. It is the first sheenless album since Please Please Me, and they now have musical chops that they didn't have back in February of 1963, and it's very much a bar band album. And yet, again, this distillation of so many styles of music, but they were doing the same thing on the BBC, on those live sessions from 1963, when they were this collective human jukebox who'd be, okay, we're going to do Ray Charles. Okay, we're going to do Jerry Lee Lewis. I feel like when they were doing that and transitioning into Arthur Alexander, they were, in effect, workshopping, woodshopping the White Album 5 years before the fact.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Speaking of the White Album, let's listen to a little bit of one of the great cuts. You know the reason why. John Lennon, as you write about in the Daily Beast, would tell his Beatles cohort that he was the best and wrote the best blues songs. There was an element of trolling, of tongue-in-cheek. Tell me your thoughts on your blues and how that came to be and what it was all about.
Trolling is certainly not my headline, but basically I think the idea that that editor was going for was that this was a bit of a tweak of the nose of the British blues boom of 1968. You have to realize in 1967 is full-blown psychedelia. In 66, you had elements of garage music, and that was kind of coalescing with pop, and then we get into the sort of drugginess of 67. 68 is the return to roots, that kind of get back, which the Beatles would later explore the following year. And you have groups like Cream and these white bands who are playing loud Otis Rush type of music at supercharged volume levels and trying to like out blues, out legitimatize each other. And it's like, oh, look how bluesy I am, right? And so Lennon decided, you know what, that's not really what we do, but I'm kind of going to ape you. And when he was aping them, as it turns out, he was in this kind of crisis himself in his life. And you never want to say that the narrator of a song is the person, just like when you're reading Ambrose Bierce or whatever you're reading, and it's like kind of grim. You don't want to assume that that's the writer. It's a separate character, unless it's labeled that way as this autobiographical confession. And here they were under the umbrella of the Beatles. So the people in these songs are more or less characters in a way, like in a novel. But Lennon was sort of writing from within the inside of everything he was feeling. So it becomes this existential howl that you don't often get in his music with the Beatles, or really ever. He himself said that he had only written two honest songs. One was being Strawberry Fields Forever, and the other being Help. I feel like emotionally, this was a very honest song from a place of pain. And even in that excerpt you just played right there, that lick at the beginning, that churning kind of kick to your gut, it sounds just like it's abrading your ears as you hear it, right?
Mm. And even... Oh, no, go ahead.
Good. It's one of the only Beatles tracks, too, where you have, and this to me is just, it's the main selling point. You have two guitar solos. You have supernumerary guitar solos. You don't really get that often. You get it like the famous guitar duel, right, at the end of Abbey Road, mm-hmm. where the Lennon, McCartney, and Harrison each take three solos three times, each lasting two bars. You get nine solos from, like, combined from all of them. And Long Tall Sally, an EP from a few years before, you get a Harrison solo and you get a Lennon solo. But the guitar solos in this song are unlike anything musically guitar-based in their catalog. There was a Soviet futuristic society, art group, called Oberu in the 1920s. And they made an experimental film called Meat Grinder. And that always puts me in mind of that. The first solo is by Lennon. It sounds like there are rocks in a garbage disposal. It is just the most chafing, violent guitar solo you will ever hear.
Check it out in the Daily Beast. And, of course, get caught up on all of Colin's work at his website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Colin, we thank you as always. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.
That's Colin Fleming here Tuesdays on Dantown.